Welcome and bienvenue to the only podcast that comes with you with a fun from the Goethe Institute this week. With me, this is your host, Gabriel Gerard, and with me this week, I have the wrath of God, Mr. Andrew Forbes.
I'm the wrath of God?
You're the wrath of God?
Yeah, I'm going to give you holy rabies.
Former mental asylum patient, Steve Power.
Former?
Bad Lieutenant Port of Call, St. John's, Jarser.
Bite off your fingers. Did I even know if you're Siberia?
And our special guest this week, the host of DVD Verdict, Sights and Sounds of Cinema, and the Grizzly Man from Georgia, Clark Douglas.
Howdy.
And we are gathered this week to discuss Mr. Werner Herzog. Born Werner Herzog Stepetek on 5 September 1942. His father was a German. His mother was a Croatian. He is reputed to have stolen his first camera at the age of 14. He stole a 35mm camera and got his knowledge from an encyclopedia film that he loved. He worked as a welder during night shifts to get the financing for his first few movies. His first movie that they made was Signs of Life, which was presented at the Cannes Film Festival. In 1970, he made the movie Even Dwarves Started Small, starring only dwarves, a freaks-inspired freakout. Fata Morgana in 1972, which is a post-apocalyptic narrative over shots of the desert. It's very experimental. In 1972, Aguirre, The Wrath of God, which was his first worldwide success, starring Klaus Kinski, with which he would collaborate and battle over the next few films. Aguirre talks about a conquistador. In 1974, he made The Enigma of Caspar Hauser, with Bruno S., which was a former mental asylum patient who plays this guy who comes out of nowhere in medieval Germany. In 1976, Art of Glass, inspired by the Pied Piper of Hamelin, for which Herzog hypnotized a lot of his actors for the movie to get the kind of atmosphere he wanted. This is one of many examples of the crazy things Mr. Herzog will do for the sake of what he calls ecstatic truth. In 1977, he reunited with Bruno S. for Strosek, which he wrote in 3 days and a half, and he shot with Bruno S.'s actual things. In 1979, a remake of the Murnau film Nosferatu with Klaus Kinski once again. In 79, Wojciech, which was shot about 4 days after they wrapped Nosferatu and was using the same crew and an exhausted Klaus Kinski. And some years later, the infamous Fitzcarraldo in 1982, which is about a man who decides to carry a ship over a mountain. And this is what Herzog did for real. And with many fights and reshoots with Klaus Kinski, there are many infamous stories. There is a documentary about the making of the film called Burden of Dreams, if you want to seek out more about that one. 1984, The Lesser Known Where the Green Ants Dream. 1997, Cobra Verde, his last collaboration with Klaus Kinski. 1991, Screening of Stone, a mountain climbing film with Donald Sutherland. In 2001, Invincible, his only movie to really touch upon Nazis and the Jews, with Tim Roth. In 2005, The Wild Blue Yonder, a mix of documentary footage of the NASA and a tale about an alien. In 2007, Rescue Dawn, which was inspired by the documentary that Herzog did years earlier called Little Detail Needs to Fly. In 2009, Bad Lieutenant and Port of Call, New Orleans with Nicolas Cage. And in 2009, again, My Son, What Have You Done? His latest American production with Willem Dafoe. So, yeah, over those years, Herzog is known as someone with a very, let's say, atmospheric way of shooting, of the wild things he will do. In his movies, like painting all black, all white rats into black, has made his both his fame and in his family. So let's go and we'll talk about Herzog. Let's start with Lou Clark, since you're our guest. What is your good or your favorite film by Mr. Herzog?
Well, this is kind of a predictable choice, I guess, but I love this movie so much, so I have to go with it. Gary, The Wrath of God is, to me, his masterpiece. Just an incredible, incredible movie and very powerful portrait of madness. It lingered with me for a really long time the first time I watched it, and it's one that I go back to regularly. A tremendous film.
I love the look of Aguirre. Like, I love the tone, I guess, and the feel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he does an amazing job of putting you in that place.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's that tremendous opening where it's just this slow, slow pan down on this seemingly endless line of, well, I guess it's a combination of Europeans way out of their element and the natives that they've hired to sort of lug all their equipment going across these mountain peaks. And it's, I mean, he just holds that shot for this unusually long period of time with this sort of droning electronic music in the background, and it's a very impactful opening.
We'd have to look, but you know, I mean, at that time, there weren't that many movies, I think, that really went, you know, on location like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the South Americas and stuff. And the way that Herzog, of course, did it with, like, minimal crew and everything helped capture, I think, the feeling of the place, mm-hmm. the kind of dreaminess.
I mean, it was essentially recreating what the characters in the film were doing, so... which seems to be something he likes to do.
Yeah, that's been something he's done on a somewhat regular basis over the course of his career. Rather than worrying about having to pay for special effects or anything like that, he just goes out and does it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind
and
of amazing.
And drags a crazy pole along with him.
Yes, indeed. And that movie, it's an incredible-looking movie. I mean, it's just gorgeous, but it was shot for next to nothing. I think mm-hmm. just over $100,000 was its budget.
Basically the cost of costumes, wasn't it?
Pretty much, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's
costumes and ammunition.
I think Michael
Well, and can... spider monkeys, of course.
Oh, we can't forget spider monkeys.
And there was at least one prosthetic head, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
So, but that was probably just, you know, a coconut with some ketchup on it or something.
Coconut and lipstick.
and even, I mean, with all of the, like, the Heart of the Darkness themes and the kind of weirdness that Herzog brings to it, you can see on its influence on stuff like Apocalypse Now, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
Pretty much anything Terrence Malick post-comeback.
Yeah.
I think my biggest thing with Aguirre, and I consider it more of my bad than my good, but I might as well just throw it in there now while we're talking about it. But I love elements of the movie immensely, and it's one of those movies. It's a great movie to get lost in for 90 minutes or an hour, you know, or 2 hours. I think it's about 90 minutes long, 130.
Yeah, 97, 98.
Yeah, I think somewhere around there, yeah. But it's
93, according to IMDb.
There you go.
But yeah, it's one of those movies. It's a great movie to get lost in, and it does kind of do a really. And I mean, I've talked about it in the past several podcasts. You know, Ridley Scott and Peter Weir and stuff. I love those transcendental movies that kind of take you to another place. But the problem I have with Aguirre is it's not a particularly pleasant place to go.
No,
it's kind of a little bit of a soul crushing slog, I guess.
Well, I'm going to jump in here too because it's my good as well.
Okay.
Andrew, I just had a little question for Clark before you step in. Since we have Clark.
I'm going to go ahead and tell you to shut up, Gabe. Go ahead.
Since we do have Clark, what do you think about the Popol Vuh score, the electronic score?
I think it's tremendously effective and... really, all of their contributions to his movies are quite something. I think they worked with him on 7 or 8 different movies, and then their later films in which he's used individual pre-existing pieces from them to great effect. But, definitely, I think a great director-composer collaboration. And one of the frustrating things for me is that some of that music isn't readily available, at least not as readily available as a lot of other soundtrack stuff. Some of it's quite hard to track down, and I don't know why, but it's really incredible stuff.
Next time Gabe goes to Berlin, we'll have to get him to hit the thrift stores and look through the LP bins.
All right, Andrew, go.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say something. but was it coherent? That's the question. Aguirre is definitely my good as well. It was also the first Herzog film I saw. And I don't think that necessarily has anything to do with it because, you know, on rewatching the ones I've seen, it still seems to hold up the best. And one thing I find peculiar about it is I find the, you know, Kinski has an amazing face.
Yes.
And he certainly got a presence.
He's such an icky bastard, man.
I'm not convinced he's actually that great an actor.
So he's just icky. He's creepy.
And he's definitely sort of like all of his, he falls in love with his sort of mannerisms and slow kind of weird move. I don't even know what it is. It's like he's kind of a man suit worn by a praying mantis who's just sort of slowly like turning and looking and then looking up and then he flips out.
when he pushes the horse over.
Yeah.
That's a classic scene.
His acting doesn't always work for me. In this one, it seems absolutely perfect. It seems like it's tied in sort of with the environment and with, I don't think you could make this film without him. There's a kind of bizarre alien quality to him that's really necessary at the heart of the movie. And whereas other films, I'm not particularly fond of his performance in Nosferatu. I'm not particularly fond of his performance in some parts of Cobra Verde. But he is, oddly enough, what sort of keeps me watching this one. So, yeah, I mean, on top of what other people have said, it's just this strange, very dreamlike, nightmarish drift down a crazy river. Sorry, I think I inadvertently evoked Robbie Roberts in there. That was not my intention.
Well, it's interesting you're saying that because that seems to be kind of a quality that Herzog looks for in a lot of his actors is I don't think he's particularly interested in people who are great actors so much as people who have an interesting presence. I mean, looking at some of the more famous folks he's been working with in recent times, you've got people like Christian Bale and Nicolas Cage and Michael Shannon and Brad Dourif. You kind of see a pattern there of these very intense
freak shows
figures, you know, who just have this magnetic, strange, otherworldly sort of presence about them.
I think the other big detriment to me with Aguirre is I find that the whole daughter subplot to be extremely icky. I don't know what it is. It just kind of turns me off. It, it,
I don't know. I had the funniest reaction when you said subplot. I was like, how can there be a subplot in a movie with no plot?
Well, yeah, okay. the plot tends to revolve around to make time with his daughter. And she's pretty cute, but she's your daughter, man.
Cozy.
Isn't she like 12? Steve, I think you might have just landed yourself on a registry.
Oh, no. Not again.
Klaus Kinski was probably on the registry.
The phone.
I don't even want to begin to imagine his romantic entanglements.
I'm making the hot collar gesture right now.
Let's get away from this. John, what's your good? Mister?
I promised myself I wasn't going to do this, but I lie to myself all the time.
And Steve convinced you to do it?
And Steve convinced me to do it. My good.
Are you going to sing your good?
As promised, Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans. I find it impossible to not absolutely love a movie that features the quote, "You don't have a lucky crack pipe." You know, it's... I heard somebody describe it as Nicolas Cage acts this movie like his head is exploding. And it's
pretty accurate.
His performance is
if
so...
If you could call it that.
Yeah, this stunning documentary of a day in the life of Nicolas Cage is
so... The average phone call to his agent probably sounds similar to
that. It's so goddamn amazing that it makes my balls throb. And I'm sorry for the foul language, everyone, but it's just, it's Bad Lieutenant. There's no other way to describe this movie.
It's a good choice, though.
Yeah, it's just, it's kind of like when we did Where was the last episode, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
And I was talking about, Mosquito Coast and Harrison Ford as a hurricane for his performance.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what Cage pulls. He acts the hell out of it, but his entire method of acting is turning the volume knob up.
Yeah. What's hilarious about Cage is, like, reading recent interviews to the guy, he's in on the joke.
Oh, yes.
He is totally aware of what he's doing, you know? Like, it's not even, you know, Nicolas Cage is a crazy person, blah, 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 blah. You know, he is actually... He's full-on, 110% aware and awake when he's doing this stuff.
He's like, Nicholas, we want you to be in a movie where you play a coked-out... Basically, take Snake Eyes, add a whole ton of cocaine, and Werner Herzog is going to direct it. Delicious. All the bad things about early to mid-90s MTV... became a movie.
I'd go so far as to say Herzog's Bad Lieutenant is better than the original, too.
I definitely think it's
better than
the
original. Yes, it's definitely.
Oh, yeah.
Because it never, ever doesn't have the illusion that it's anything serious. It's, you know, it's...
Whereas Abel Ferreira might be the most...
My memory of Natural Born Killers was. You know, it's just that strap yourself in.
I know Ferreira hates it.
Going back to the comparison, I mean, the Ferreira movie is essentially like seriousness the movie.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Let's see how far we can push it. You know?
Whereas this movie is, hey, let's put a camera on Nicolas Cage, Val Kilmer, and exhibit and see what misadventures have.
There's a Herzog quote, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he was asked to describe the differences between the Ferreira Bad Lieutenant and his. And he said that Ferreira's movie was about the anguish of being evil, and he said his movie was about the joy of being evil.
Nice.
And I think that pretty much sums it up.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons I love Herzog, see? Like, as a person?
Yeah.
little bits of gold like that.
I wonder if he gave that quote while he was flipping a burning car over or, like, you know, like, doing hack squats like he was at the gym just lifting immense amounts of weight.
I don't know about that, but I do know in that same interview he compared Pereira to Don Quixote tilting at windmills.
Nice.
So
nice.
Yeah, it's like the man is undeniably intelligent, and I don't want to say he's insane because he's too clever for
it. He is one charming crazy person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He is the coolest coolest hobo you have ever spoken to. And Bad Lieutenant is like if somebody let that hobo draw a comic book. And that's why I love it so much.
Nice.
It should have been a train wreck, and it is. But it's the train wreck where you know, the train is full of pillows.
So the train now I crashing. Really, really want to crash a train full of pillows.
And I will say, I don't want to, you know, spoil the movie or anything for people who haven't seen it, but I will say it does attain a little bit of kind of depth towards the end when it takes the sort of left turn that it does with the resolution. That really surprised me, and it turned out to be a more thought-provoking movie than like the first 90 minutes or so lead you to believe it's going to be.
Yeah,
it does kind of pull the smoke and aces. Mm-hmm. That's what I call it.
And I think that's the first time I've heard Smoke and Aces used that way.
Yeah, it pulls the smoke and aces. No, it's completely...
I was just thinking, is how many people are even going to understand that?
Go watch Smoke and Aces. It's a fantastic...
You and the two other guys who went to see Smoke and Aces.
It's a fantastic movie. Don't laugh.
I actually have to go see it now that I... Because I'm in love with The Gray. And so now I'm like, oh, I should... Go and watch another Joe Carnahan movie.
All I gotta say,
Get your hopes up that high because The Gray is so much. I mean, I like Joe Carnahan, but The Gray is so much better than everything else he's done.
The thing is, I think my expectations are going to be in the middle because I love The Gray and I hated that movie with Jason Patrick and Narc. Narc.
Yeah.
Smoke and Aces. That was an overrated movie. It's Guy Ritchie filtered through America for the first like 90 minutes, and then it becomes intensely dark.
Mm.
And it's
right, Steve.
So it's Guy Ritchie filtered through America, and then the last 10 minutes is Revolver filtered through.
Dribbled over Ryan Reynolds' abs.
Anyway, we were talking about Herzog, weren't we?
Yeah, Steve. What's your good for Herzog?
This podcast is like a Herzog movie. It doesn't make sense.
I was just gonna say, if you're expecting a focus about podcasts, and especially if you're expecting focus on the Herzog episode. You're listening to the wrong group of people.
The wrong podcast. Steve, what's your good for Herzog?
My good for Herzog, I had to go with Rescue Down, actually. Because as much as I like, or I can't even say like, as much as I can appreciate his early work, for me, Rescue Down was, and I mean, it's an analogy I use a lot on this podcast. I always say, you know, the best directors know how to balance self-indulgence and accessibility. Those two factors kind of have to combine to make this perfect balance, and that's when you get the perfect movies. And I think for Herzog, I think Rescue Down was, you know, he took the story and he honed it to, like, you know, a Hollywood shine, but then he used his own style to tell it. And then, of course, you had Christian Bale acting the hell out of it, and you had Steve Zahn, of all people, acting the hell out of it, you know? Yeah.
And then you had Jeremy Davies on the Jeremy Davies Mannerism Show.
Jeremy Davies' performance that I just can't even sit through. It's so obnoxious as Solaris, the remake.
Oh my god!
it's so.
I'm just imagining. I don't know how anyone could be. You know, if you want to go insane in space, be the only other crew member with Jeremy Davies. I would launch that guy out of an airlock like within 5 minutes. Sorry. Continue Rescue Dawn.
It was a good movie. It was entertaining, well acted, beautifully filmed, absolutely stunning looking. And you know, like I don't know what it is about Vietnam movies. I just enjoy Vietnam movies for whatever reason. I love Platoon, I love Apocalypse Now, you know. And Rescue Dawn for me was like kinda it felt like the first one to come along in a while that had any kind of a meaningful impact. It wasn't just like, you know, the machine gun show for 90 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was an entertaining, you know, good war flick. I quite enjoyed it. I mean, beyond that, it was a survival flick, and I love survival movies. So, you know.
And there was that terrific shot when they were all running over that rope bridge.
Mm.
I don't know why that shot sticks in my head, but it does.
It was just, it was a beautiful looking movie.
Aerial shots.
I think it has something in common with The Wrath of God, too, which is how it captures the oppressiveness of the jungle. I mean, everything's so just overbearing once they make their escape. It's also lush and green, but it feels just kind of suffocating.
And foreboding, yeah.
Yeah.
Going through the jungle isn't walking through a forest. It's walking through a wall that's, you know, 30 miles deep. And you just have to keep chipping away at the wall. And you get that feeling in those movies.
Who's next?
Woo. I'm next. My good for Werner Herzog is 1974, The Enigma of Kaspar Hauser. Now, first of all, I have to mention this. I'm sorry. It is one of my favorite things about this movie is the original German title, which translates as Everyone for Himself, but God Against All. I think that's a great title.
Great title.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The movie, what I get from it is like, I just remember the first time I started watching it, and you have a brief prelude, and then you have a title screen, and it's like oats or something flowing in the wind, and there's a Pachelbel's cannon playing in the background, and the wind is like kind of doing rhythm with it. I mean, just that shot for me, like, just sucked me in the movie right away. But then you get to this guy who's sitting in a cellar, which is our nominal protagonist, Kaspar Hauser, who's basically been shackled in an attic and kept there most of his life. And one day he's released into a medieval town and becomes an object of curiosity, interest, and fear. I mean, this movie, just the recreation, I find, of the times, it is very impressive with the costumes and everything, and it feels lived down, like when we're talking about Verhoeven and Flesh and Bone, you know, like that kind of like medieval, like it's kind of dirty everywhere and
scuzzy.
You don't want to be there. And I mean the most striking thing, of course, is the performance by Bruno S, who is, I don't know, he's just one of a kind, I guess. He's so naturalistic. Herzog just found him and put him in this role. And he's kind of fascinating. And this is a kind of, like, fairy tale for grown-ups, I guess. It's a very hypnotizing and I find even thought-provoking film.
Hypnotizing is a good word for a lot of Herzog's movies. They've just got this strange quality about them that kind of sucks you in, even when there's not a lot technically happening on screen.
Yeah, I'm always thinking that I'm always thinking of the phrase "you are getting sleepy." I'm just kidding.
But yeah, Gabe, like you were saying, Bruno S. is another presence. He's a very different presence from Klaus Kinski, but another guy who's not necessarily a great actor in the classical sense. I mean, he probably couldn't do Death of a Salesman or anything like that, but
no.
He's a very, very interesting guy, and even though he's very childlike and he's very simple, you're always wondering what he's thinking and how much he's comprehending, and you can't take your eyes off him the whole time.
Yeah, and I mean, he brings some interesting social issues, and the way the movie ends, which is another thing that a lot of Herzog movies have. They have this last frame or last segment, which is very, very striking.
That movie also reminds me, it feels kind of like a Bergman movie in spots, too, especially in the big circus sequence. where you have this guy introducing these different kind of freak show acts, and it feels both kind of exploitative and really tender at the same time.
Yeah, definitely. And although the difference to me in my mind is that although Herzog is, of course, as stylized as Bergman, he's different in that way where you still it still kind of feels realist, you know, even though he has the style and the atmosphere going on. It's less removed than a Bergman movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the few that I haven't seen, actually.
And
I didn't have a chance to track that one down.
I think, if memory serves, that and Strosek are the only two that Bruno did with Herzog.
I believe so.
But I know Herzog had been planning to cast him in Wojcik, but then decided that he wasn't up for the part.
Yeah, or I think he was casting him, and then Kinski got free or something like that.
Yeah.
Kinski got free of the cage.
they let Kinski out.
He's loose.
But yeah, I mean, if you get this is a pretty particular movie. If you're interested, track it down. People who haven't heard of this one, because I think Herzog's mostly known for the few Kinski movies, and then, of course, that is more recent stuff. But moving on to more bads, to reiterate, The Bad is not necessarily a bad movie. It's a movie that has too many flaws to be totally good, or a movie that you really, really like, although it's deeply flawed. And we'll go, I guess let's go with John.
John, what's your bad?
My bad is Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans. because as much as I love how completely out there Nicolas Cage is and completely out there most of the movie is, as a police procedural, it's really, really, really boring. You know,
John,
did you watch
any other movies?
Sorry?
Did you watch any other movies?
I watched Fitzcarraldo.
Okay.
But that Bad Lieutenant deserves this. It's, once you get past the gimmick, or once you watch the movie and not smoke the finest pipe weed
in the South
Further. In all the South Further, it's actually a pretty bad movie.
Somebody's chair sounds like an impression of a dinosaur falling off a cliff.
It's not me.
But I would agree with that part, John, that the procedural, I guess, like...
Yeah, I'd agree with your hastily prepared ranking. it's the actual cop part of the story up until the climax with Cage and Exhibit is, it's just, you know, you're sitting there waiting for the next...
Mm-hmm.
The next day, why is there fucking iguana on my coffee table?
So much of the movie is played kind of straight, I guess, or played kind of retarded, I should say, that when it does kind of straighten up and fly, you're waiting for the zaniness to come back. You're kind of missing the lunacy, maybe?
It's a very, very difficult movie to watch.
Like, that tends to be a trend, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. and to me, like, when I was watching it, there was, you know, I could see that Herzog film it because it was beautifully done, but for me it didn't really feel like a Herzog movie, although it's still weird, of course, but besides that,
you don't of Eva Mendes.
I think if they do a third one, I would love to see David Lynch do it. Or like go back in the time capsule and get Cronenberg from 1983 to direct it.
With James Woods.
There we go.
I think James Woods already kind of did that movie though with Cop.
Yeah.
But Cop was awesome. Awesomely bland. Cop was the last line of the movie.
I don't remember anything about it other than that James Woods was a corrupt cop.
I just remember the video cover. Corrupt? He's James Woods. He's got to be corrupt, it like even James if they Woods? Don't say anything in the movie. You just assume that there's a human trafficking operation going all on.
Wasn't he like scowling and pointing a gun or something like that?
Next time I see a cop who's scowling, I'm going to internal affairs. I know what you're up to with your not fantastic attitude.
I remember he has a very Dennis Leary rant at his about the bedtime stories he tells his daughter. And I remember what he says to the villain at the end of it. And it has nothing to do with Bad Lieutenant, but...
Clark, what's your bad?
I know I mentioned to some of you guys earlier that I was probably going to go with Wojciech, but I changed my mind on that after I was thinking about it. And I'm going to go with one of his more recent efforts, which is My Son, What Have You Done? Which is a really – it's an interesting experiment which doesn't quite work. And, John, I think you were talking about David Lynch a second ago. It's actually a movie produced by David Lynch, and when I first heard about it, I was kind of excited at the prospect of Lynch and Herzog teaming up and what kind of crazy thing they might come up with together.
I think all crazy just kind of canceled it out, though.
Yeah, it ends up feeling kind of like a diluted riff on a lot of their earlier movies. And if you thought that Bad Lieutenant didn't really work as a cop procedural, this one is even less effective in that regard. It's kind of a series of random moments strung together by a plot, which is kind of sort of cop procedural. And sometimes with Herzog movies, that's enough because those random moments are so fascinating and intriguing. But in this case, they just feel, I don't know, like the director's just kind of doing what he feels is expected of him. There doesn't feel like a whole lot of real motivation behind this one. I mean, I'm sure there is, but I don't know. It just didn't click with me, even though there's some interesting moments, some interesting performances. Michael Shannon, I think, is a terrific actor, and he's the lead actor in this one. But yeah, it's kind of an experiment for me.
It's it was an interesting movie. I didn't hate it. I didn't love it. You know, it was just kind of like I didn't regret watching it, I guess.
But I
think
that
was on the DVD case.
It was one of those movies that I kind of, you know, when it came out, there was a little bit of hype around it. There was another one too. There was a. What was that one? It was I think it was a Sidney Lumet. It was like one of his last movies or something came out too. Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Before The Devil Knows You're Dead.
Yeah, they both came out around the same time, and there was a lot of talk about both of them, and I think I watched them both the same night. And the other definitely left more of an impression, we'll say. You know, like it was definitely... That one was kind of like, huh, okay.
Was it just the Marissa Tomei effect?
It was. Who keeps hiring her?
Before The Devil Knows You Did That, it's a really good flick.
Yeah, it is a fantastic movie.
Mm.
While Steve is talking, what's your bad, Steve?
My bad, I actually kind of hit on it earlier with Aguirre, Wrath of God, and that is, like, I mean, for the reasons I mentioned earlier, as much as I love the visuals and I love, like, how... You know, how it really takes you to that horrible, horrible place. It is, in point of fact, a horrible, horrible place that's not necessarily fun to visit. And I find the lack of narrative, it's, you know, I bring up the comparison because it's definitely an influence, but I always, when I see Aguirre, I always think of Malick. I always think of The Thin Red Line or The New World. And with those two movies... Malick is—he's very much in that same, you know, that art house kind of vibe. But when you sit down and you think about them, they're really pretty simple and straightforward. You know, there's not a whole lot. It's not like the Tree of Life where it's all interpretation and yada, yada, yada. I mean, The New World and The Thin Red Line are pretty simple, straightforward narratives. They're both, you know, they're just certain people's. It's all about perspective. It's all about point of view. And there's not really anything there that you need to interpret or whatever. It's either it's the type of movie you can sit down and digest and enjoy, or you can't. Whereas with Aguirre, it's kind of... It's that same type of kind of meandering narrative, but it doesn't really seem to have a point. It doesn't really seem to have that underpinning like The Thin Red Line does or The New World does. You know, like, with The Thin Red Line, you had World War II. With The New World, you had, you know, the discovery of America or whatever. Whereas with this, it's kind of... With Aguirre, it's the search for El Dorado. Okay, fine and dandy, but, you know, that's... It's there at the very, very beginning, and then it just kind of vanishes. It all just kind of turns into this... I don't even know what. Let's just see how batshit crazy Klaus Kinski can be before the credits roll. And then the end comes, and it just kind of sits there for a while, and credits roll. And you're kind of like, well, that was abrupt. There's not really any finality. There's not. I mean, well, you know the outcome, but the movie doesn't really... I don't know. I wasn't satisfied, I guess is the word. So much of that movie I like, and I can sit down and I can watch it purely as, like, you know, a moving painting. But as a movie, as a narrative story, I just kind of I think it's a bit weak. So that's why
I can see that.
Yeah, that's why I go Aguirre. And I mean,
oh, it's got monkeys, Steve.
It's lots of monkeys. he even holds up a monkey and kind of cradles it at the end, and it's so cute. While he's talking about being the wrath of God and marrying his daughter. But, you know, it's... I don't know. The movie just kind of... I guess it leaves me cold. And that's a complaint. Again, it's measured at Malick a lot. I hear a lot of people say that. Like, you know, Malick just leaves them with a bad taste in their mouth. They can't handle the dullness of his movies. But I find Malick to be so... I guess introspective is the word. You know, like, Malick kind of looks inward when he's making his movies. He kind of... He really wants to get into emotions and what people are feeling and stuff, whereas I think Herzog is more abstract and he just kind of sits back and watches. And
he watches people being introspective.
Yeah, and it's not the same. It's not the same.
I mean, I didn't really mention it in the intro, but Herzog has done a lot more documentaries than he has done fiction movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can definitely see that in his feature movies, where this guy is more interested in recording, you know, than making up stories.
He's more interested in observing a story than telling a story.
Yeah, exactly.
I know we're focused on his narrative features here, but I do have to say I've always felt that he's a stronger documentarian than he is a traditional filmmaker, because that's where the kind of disconnect between him and his subject is removed, and you really get Werner Herzog himself actually being introspective about these things. And he's an incredibly fascinating thinker. He views the world in a way that I think is really unique and compelling. And a lot of that shines through very, very strongly in his documentaries. And he's made some really fascinating films in that realm, because he's not so much interested in simply recreating the events of what happened in a particular situation as just sort of meditating on the angles of what happened that really fascinate him. And it leads to some very distinctive films.
I agree 100% with that.
Mm-hmm. All right, Andrew, what's your bad?
My bad is Cobra Verde. And I'm gonna read out the synopsis. It's not super spoilery, I don't think. But the little IMDb synopsis, and the reason will be clarified afterwards. The feared bandit Cobra Verde, played by Klaus Kinski, is hired by a plantation owner to supervise his slaves. After the owner suspects Cobra Verde of consorting with his young daughters, the owner wishes him gone. Rather than kill him, the owner sends Cobra Verde to Africa. The only white man in the area, Cobra Verde finds himself the victim of torture and humiliation. Later, he trains soldiers in a rebel army. Far from home, Cobra Verde is on the edge of madness. That synopsis is how this movie feels, structurally. That sort of disconnected, episodic,
lack of cohesion. It's just this is happening, and then this is happening, and then this is happening. Now, this is my bad. It's not my ugly. I would say Herzog, I find, creates some amazing images, but I find his visual style very inconsistent. And I find often a fantastic image is right next to a very ordinary, almost sloppy feeling bit of camera work. It's kind of like you're cutting back and forth between Malick and George Romero, like just grabbing whatever coverage he can in some strange way. Some of his movies feel that way to me, mostly the older stuff. Cobra Verde is the most consistently spectacular looking movie of his, I think, that I've seen. It just looks phenomenal all the way through. It's almost like, especially at the beginning, it almost feels like Herzog has decided that he's going to do Sergio Leone. And you get these amazing sort of arid landscapes and then extreme close-ups on crazy eyes, Kinski. and so it's a phenomenal movie to look at. There are some tremendous scenes. However, again, it doesn't feel like it holds together. Kinski's performance doesn't feel like it holds together. There are moments where he's absolutely terrific. There are moments where it's obvious that he's just kind of going crazy. And Herzog is filming him, sort of abusing the various African extras. And yet, at the same time, it's a movie that I kind of always, of all his movies, it's the one I feel like I should always go back to. It's a bit like, for Cronenberg, Naked Lunch for me is a movie that really doesn't work as a movie. But at the same time, there's so much in there that I want it to work. So I keep going back to it and being disappointed, but then going back to it and going back to it because it has all of these sort of nuggets of fantasticness just kind of jumbling about. That's what this one is like for me.
All right. For my bad, I picked Fritz Kuralo.
No discussion. No discussion on mine. No, let's just move this train right on.
Well, I didn't hear anyone chime in. I'm sorry, Forbes. Do they want to have anything to say about Cobra Verde?
I will say I basically agree. it's an interesting movie, but it doesn't entirely work. And you're right, it's a movie that I keep wanting it to, especially since it was their last collaboration together. Mm-hmm. And Kinski's, it's also probably his most inconsistent performance, but it also has some real moments. Mm-hmm. That are
also
quite,
there's something about, I don't know if it was just his age then or combined with the environments, but there's this combination of, he's still got that sort of the handsomeness he had in his youth, but there's a bit more weathered, a bit more of a weathered quality to him. And so just as a physical presence, he's quite something in it.
Yes.
I think it's, right, Gabe, it's one of the few movies that I saw Kinski in where he felt kind of at home. You know, he didn't feel like out of place.
Because he was playing a crazy man abusing everyone.
Yeah, impregnating farmers.
All right. So I was saying Fitzcarraldo. This, as I said earlier, is a movie about, it's based on a guy who actually did this, who decided to carry a big steam power ship across the Andes. And this is what watching this movie feels like. Mm-hmm. It feels like you're working right behind him and you're trying to stroll up the the ship yourself. Like we said earlier, Herzog does have usually an hypnotic feel, and even his moments of slowness are kind of interesting. But this movie really drags. it feels like forever to me. I mean, I can't, you know, put away the achievement. And, I mean, this is a movie I worked really hard on. I think originally was, like, shooting with Mick Jagger and Jason Robards. And Jagger had to leave to tour with the Stones or something. And then, of
course,
that's
got to be a good excuse when you're on a movie like this. Oh, yeah, I got to go. I got this thing, you know, 20,000 people in a stadium. Sorry.
And of course, Kinski being this terrifying worst as a person on the set. So yeah, I mean, this is a movie where I think the making of might actually be more interesting than the movie. You know, as if like you know, if you've seen Apocalypse Now and House of Darkness, if Apocalypse Now wasn't really successful, you still have a pretty good documentary right there.
Also, Claudia Cardinale.
Yeah, Claudia Cardinale.
I have to stick up for Fitzcarraldo a little bit. I really love this movie, and you are right when you say that you feel like you're right there with them along every step of this incredibly tedious journey of putting this process in place to move the ship over the mountains and everything. And it does go on a long time, and I think the movie is a little longer than it needs to be. But I think those moments are really well captured, and they go a long way towards making kind of the big sort of sensational set piece moments all the more exhilarating. I mean, because to me, for whatever else that movie does, right or wrong, when you actually see that ship moving over the mountain, it's just an incredible image and one that just really gives me goosebumps every time. It's a long way getting there, but I think there's really a lot of interesting stuff along the way too. I like the movie's kind of appropriately operatic tone, the way it opens up with Kinski sort of madly paddling in from the water and rushing up to the opera house and demanding that he needs to see this guy, and just he has this burning desire to build this opera house in the middle of nowhere, and it just kind of starts at this fever pitch and goes from there. It's a really effective movie, an imperfect one, but
that's why it's my bad and not my ugly. You know, it is this interesting movie that could manage to be cut somewhat. I mean, it is really interesting and a good like it does have a nice epic feel to it too.
Yeah. And it's interesting too. Herzog, even though he makes a lot of movies that feel kind of epic in nature, he doesn't really make great big long movies most of the time. But that one's an exception. Over 2.5 hours, it really is a huge movie in every way to a degree that most of his stuff isn't.
I lost hair watching this movie.
Yeah, blame it on this. Blame it on Fitzcarraldo.
Klaus Kinski is the most. That was definitely the most Irish performance of an Irishman I've ever seen.
So now I guess we can move on to our uglies and to our opinion. What is the worst movie that Herzog ever directed? And this one's up for grabs. Who wants to go first?
Can I go first?
No.
Why not?
Fine.
Okay. Just to continue the conversation, I think it's Geraldo. it was...
What a dick.
it was the Klaus Kinski show, even more so than Aguirre and Cobra Verde. You know, like, it was entirely the Klaus Kinski show, and he was just... He was running that set like Mel Gibson in the early 80s, you know? It was just... Oh, and... He, like we said earlier, he's just not very good. I mean, yes, he had a presence, but I found him terrible. I found him really, really poor. And
you know what else has a presence? Your cat shits.
And I just, it really, the whole movie to me felt like something that just kind of got away from the director, it felt like a mess. And, it, you know, with a lot of his other stuff, I mean, like, yeah, there might be stuff that Herzog does that's not to my tastes, or there might be stuff he does that's a little more abstract than I typically like, or whatever, for whatever reason, but Fitzcarraldo, to me, felt like it just got away from him. It just, it felt like a movie that completely ran away from him. And it, there's one thing about Herzog is, even at his most random and abstract, he's typically in control. Like, he typically knows what he's showing you. Whereas with Fitzcarraldo, it just felt like a mad scramble. Like, and for a movie that's, you know, 2.5 hours long, about and just plotting, you know, just kind of moving along at a snail's pace, for it to feel so disheveled and so just, you know, frantic, I guess is the word, in terms of how it's constructed. I think that's part of why the movie feels so long. I think that's what part of why the pacing is so off, is just because they tried to piece it together as best they could. You know, it's like the first time, the famous Star Wars story, you know, the first time George Lucas sat down and watched his assembly cut of Star Wars, he had his head in his hand going, this is a disaster. You know, I can't help but feel the same way about Fitzcarraldo. There's no way that movie came out the way it was originally intended to be.
In conclusion, Fitzcarraldo, it's like Star Wars.
No!
Saying, right?
No. Absolutely not. It's about a boy, a girl, and a universe. Wait, what? No. No, it's just, you know, it feels like a movie that just completely ran away from him. It feels like something he had no control over, and that, like I said, normally that's something Herzog, if nothing else, he usually feels controlled, and here it was just, to me it felt like Kinski just kind of had too much influence, and just, you know, they worked with what they could get, kind of like the stories you hear about Brando and Apocalypse Now, you know, like, you know, he just kind of threw whatever shit he could at the screen, and whatever managed to stick, Herzog kind of shot around it, and I don't think the movie really works. Like, I didn't find it engaging. I didn't find it intriguing. He's not a likable character. I mean, you're going to make a movie that's 2.5 hours long about a protagonist who's trying to pull a steamship across a mountain. Make the character relatable. Make him someone you want to root for. You know, make him someone you really want to see succeed. And that way, when he does succeed, it's really great and satisfying. And when he fails, it's heart-wrenching and terrible. And this movie was neither. You know, like, it was just, okay, well, that was a movie.
Or was it?
I call it my ugly. Like, there are other movies by Herzog that I like less, but this one is my ugly because to me, like, for me, it's his biggest, I guess, failure.
It certainly doesn't seem to have been a pleasant experience for him watching Burden of Dreams. It inspired those great nihilistic monologues about nature and the jungle and how horrific they are.
And I saw Burden of Dreams a while later, like it was quite a while after I'd seen the movie that I saw Burden of Dreams, and I initially kind of fell into it on YouTube. I was just looking at, I believe it was Eclipse from Aguirre. This was a while ago. And kind of came across Burden of Dreams there and then had to track it down. And, yeah. Yeah. I agree with the Native Chief, the guy who offered to kill Klaus Kinski. He's like, do you want me to murder this man? Yes. Yes, please. Who's going to know?
Probably not be necessary.
Just on a completely, mostly unrelated note, I have a cat in the room right now, which is acting like Klaus Kinski. She just came up and bit me really hard on the ankle for no reason,
would,
and then just
would
wandered
you
off.
Like me to kill her for you?
No.
I like my cat. I'd rather you didn't.
I'm a masochist, so it all works out.
All right, who's next? Go ahead, Lou.
All right. I'm going to qualify this because otherwise Gabe will cry. And also people will be really annoyed at me. But this is a movie, I think it may fall in line with sort of Steve's reasoning in that maybe fell the shortest of potential for me. So a failure, I would say. And in honesty, it's more, it's definitely more in the bad category than the ugly. This is just because, frankly, I haven't seen a huge range of Herzog's movies. I'm letting you know that now at the end. And that's, so my air quotes ugly end air quotes, is Nosferatu. There's some terrific stuff at the beginning with Jonathan Harker, you know, going into the mountains, and then his arrival at the castle. That's pretty cool. The rest of this movie put me to sleep. I tried to watch it. I've come back to it a number of times. I've tried to watch it about four times. And it's just every single time, with a couple of exceptions, and despite some very, very nice music, I just hate it. I really don't like Klaus Kinski's performance. He just seems like a shy, creepy guy who hangs out at the library and wants to make friends. But then it's like, oh, I'm also going to drink your blood. You know, the original Nosferatu.
Interested, does he?
No. Also, something bothers me about it. The original Nosferatu, I think, was certainly trying to be a horror movie. It was trying to scare people. It had a pace that was expected of films at that time. Herzog basically recreates the pace of the silent film in 1979, and there's really no need for it. And we end up with these stretches of people just kind of sitting and looking sad in drab surroundings. And it's just, I don't know.
Have you ever read Dracula, Andrew?
I have not read the novel.
The Stoker novel. All right, because it didn't. Yeah, it's pretty long. It really reflects the novel, I find.
You know, that only goes so far for me. You know, a movie's a movie; it has to stand on its own. And if you know, it's great if he's reflecting the horribly boringness of the novel. But it's just like it's absolutely lifeless. I find. Completely lifeless. But, you know, I love Bruno Ganz. Bruno Ganz is a terrific actor. Isabella Gianni has been in some really good stuff. The guy who plays Renfield, I was set on fire. But I mean, other than that, I mean, you know, the leads are pretty good. But I just, it's like, for me, it's like being... what's his face at the end of 2001, sleeping in that horribly decorated room, being an old man. That's, I feel like him when I watch this movie.
I have to come to the defense. I'll go of course the completely opposite way of every performance that I've seen by Klaus Kinski. This is probably my favorite.
In his defense, I think it's the most consistent, and it seems like he was actually under control, and it almost seems like, you know, he actually created a character instead of just being his own crazy guy. But I didn't enjoy watching the character. So,
but I mean, he's not supposed to be enjoyable.
But there's a difference between a character who one dislikes or who makes one uncomfortable, and a performance that just puts you to sleep. And it's alternating irritation and boredom when I'm watching him in this.
I could get behind that.
But I really like the music, especially when there's that one shot of that crazy light around the cliffside and the carriage is coming at night, and it's, you know, that's good.
I think one of my favorite shots in the movie is the rats, which of course, you know, Herzog actually let loose a, a, a couple of rats in the city, I don't know, 1,000 or 100, I don't know.
That's a dick move.
Yeah.
I think one of the interesting things about Kinski's performance of that movie to me is that he plays Dracula as much more of a monster than most actors seem to. It's a very kind of primal take on that character. And, you know, usually you see a lot of actors playing Dracula with this kind of suave elegance. You know, this European playboy, basically, with a taste for blood. But Kinski's is a lot more intimidating than that, I think.
I think it reflects the Max Schreck performance in that regard.
Yeah.
I mean,
it does.
The original Nosferatu performance, he was a creature, you know? I don't think you can... This isn't a criticism necessarily, but I'm not sure how much credit you can really give Kinski for taking that approach.
Sure.
Because, I mean, that was the source as well, to at least some degree.
And one of the things that I've always heard about this movie is that Herzog was apparently kind of in love with the original. And he's not really a movie guy. Like, he claims he's only watched a few dozen movies in his life. But he really loved the original and wanted to just kind of poke around inside that movie in the present to as great a degree as he could, and his Nosferatu is basically the product of that, which is it seems like kind of a thin sort of excuse to make a movie, but an interesting one at least.
I think it's kind of cool, and as much as I'm not a fan of the movie, the idea of him remaking a film like from the silent era and stuff like that, you know, it kind of came along before, you know, nowadays, you know, remakes, everybody hates a remake. Everybody, as soon as a remake or reimagining appears, people start pointing their thumb in the general direction of the movie. And, you know, it's become...
But this was, and it's worth saying that this was a remake of, I mean, the fact that it was Nosferatu and not another adaptation of Dracula, this was a remake of a movie.
Yeah.
It was not another interpretation of a piece of literature.
But the idea of making, you know, something that couldn't have been achieved, and I mean, like, the original Nosferatu is an amazing film. I mean, as a silent film, it's absolutely incredible. But taking that film and recreating it with what were then modern techniques, you know, like, it's not like, you know, Gus Van Sant doing Psycho just as a total vanity project and doing a shot-for-shot remake. You know, it was, you know, taking something that he enjoyed, but he obviously saw that had narrow appeal, and like, and kind of trying to modernize it for you know, the then-current movie-going audience, or what would typically be his movie-going audience. I kind of applaud that. That takes, you know, a certain amount of chutzpah to pull off.
And like I said, you know, honestly, it's certainly more of a bad than an ugly for me, really. It's just my options were limited.
And of course, another thing that's interesting is the fact that Herzog did choose this old German movie, too. Because, I mean, it was part of what is often called the new wave of German cinema.
Yeah.
With other people like Wim Wenders or Rainer Fassbinder. And they pretty much, you know, ignored the past of the German movies because they were like, well, after the war, we have to forge, like, our new identity and like, show the present and everything. So this was, like, a tie to, like, let's go back. You know, there was something good here before the Nazis, you know.
Now I want to see him remake Triumph of the Will. With Nicolas Cage.
Oh, man.
Nicolas Cage is Adolf Hitler.
That's my cue.
I think I'd rather see him remake it in a more documentary-style format with him musing on what the Nazis must be thinking as they march around.
That would be the most calm and zen Nazi movie ever made.
If it would.
But, you know, just have some dramatic reenactments with Nicolas Cage.
John, go, John, what's your ugly?
Hitler would also have to cradle a spider monkey at some point.
You already know what my... And rape his daughter. You already know what my ugly is.
Bad Lieutenant.
Bad LT. Port of Call, New Orleans. So, I just got to get it out there. This movie is so unilaterally fucking deplorable that it makes my balls drop. Yeah, like, sure, it was cool seeing Nick Cage get his groove back.
But you've
heard me say why it was good. You've heard me say why it was bad. And in the battle between those two directions, all that's left is a hot mess. Is this movie a thriller? Is it a satire? Is it a long stare into the hollow eyes of an addict as the fuse finally runs out? Yes, it's entertaining. It's hilarious to watch Nicolas Cage smoke crack.
But, lucky crack pipe.
Yeah, but no, his exhibit had the lucky crack pipe.
Oh, okay.
What else is there? Like, do you know?
A PSA about the dangers of back pain.
Back pain.
Does Herzog even care?
I thought that's what The Master was about.
Like, the miracles of modern science, the combined intellect of 80,000 years of human evolution, has not yet devised a means to calculate how little as shit Werner Herzog gives about this movie.
I kind of got that impression, too, to be honest.
Yeah. And the 20-year-old pretentious art student I once was wants to call it a laugh and a half. I have to call it bullshit. You know, there's not even enough movie here to call it one. It was
basically, there was a property, a producer had the rights to Bad Lieutenant.
Yeah.
The title. And it was like, oh, you know, New Orleans is fucked. Let's film it.
It's as if, like, Roger Corman had called up Werner Herzog, you know?
That's kind of what it plays out like. It kind of plays out a little bit like an exploitation film.
Yeah.
You know, you can practically hear, you know, that Quentin Tarantino grindhouse guy doing the voiceover on the trailer, you know?
Well, didn't we already describe it as exploitative but tender? Or was that another one?
I don't entirely recall.
It's how I like my love life.
Exploitative.
Christ. Why do I stop?
I still think, though, like in those final 15, 20 minutes, when the movie starts really kind of digging at something more, it kind of transcends that kind of B-movie vibe that it has going on.
See, I'm cool with that. Like, I'm cool with, you know, Cage realizing, oh, shit, I'm still a cop. But then you get that scene where the prisoner comes back and says, you know, hey, man, you saved my life. And why does Cage say to him, do fish dream or something
like
that? Yeah,
do fish even dream?
Yeah, I'm just like, seriously, man? Really?
I'm going to help you not panic anymore, Nicolas Cage. Tuesday's coming. Did you bring your...
Before we close the book on Bad Lieutenant, I have to say this. Iguana point of view shot.
Shoot them again. Their souls are still dancing.
What are those iguanas doing on my coffee table?
There ain't Then what the fuck is this?
I love Val Kilmer in that movie.
Oh, yeah.
I think they should have shot Val Kilmer in that movie, though, like they did him in True Romance, where you never see his face. Is Nicolas Cage's partner even there? Is it Elvis?
The weirdest thing about the cast in that movie is Michael Shannon is there, like, doing nothing.
Yeah.
And by that point, he was a pretty well-established actor, but he's just kind of there lingering. I guess waiting for my son, what have you done to start? But I don't know what he's doing in that movie exactly.
I thought you said 11. Said 11, right? No. 12. Got there early.
But at least there's Brad Dourif.
To me, man, it's when I look back at it, it's more like, you know, like Forbes was saying, you know, they got a property. They attached the director to it. He, you know, he kind of like assembled a dream team that he was going to, you know, do this send up, fuck you to, you know, the producer who hired him. And, you know, kind of like that, kind of like Dope Smoker by Sleep. it's like he gets going with it and then just gets bored.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he does get bored, though. I mean, I think that movie has some interesting stuff going on all the way through. And I do love that. I think more people should, in doing remakes, just kind of, you know, do their own thing with it. And I love that he did that. He just sort of said, okay, the title's Bad Lieutenant, I'll run with that. Yeah, exactly. You know, he made a Werner Herzog movie. He had an obligation to make a movie about a bad lieutenant, which he did. But beyond that, it's its own thing that has nothing to do with the Abel Ferrara film, and I'm completely happy with that.
Werner, I'm concerned that Lieutenant isn't bad enough. I'm not worried.
Let's have him brutalize a couple.
My Lieutenant.
All right, Clark, what is your ugly?
My ugly is a very early Herzog film called Even Dwarfs Started Small.
That was going to be my good.
I'm almost enough of a Werner Herzog fan to call myself a Herzog apologist, but this is one of his only movies that I kind of tedious.
I watched it.
There's enough of a good idea there for a really interesting, maybe like 20-minute short film, but at over 90 minutes, it's just kind of excruciating. And it also, even though he uses kind of exploitation movie elements every now and then, it's also the only one of his movies which feels exploitative kind of in a really uncomfortable way and not in an artistically satisfying way either. It just feels like he's doing a lot of sort of shocking stuff just for its own sake in this movie.
Yeah.
And the routine gets old really quickly because it kind of feels like it's on repeat by the 30-minute mark.
Mm-hmm.
That's the
I chose Dwarfs for my good, for my ugly two, sorry. Whoa, I'm tired. So for my ugly two, I mean, like Clark said, it feels very much like, I'll just do crazy stuff, and it feels like this is like one of the only movies where I would really throw pretentious at Herzog, you know, like he's doing the film student thing, and oh, look how freaky I can be, and I've watched Freaks, you know.
One of us.
But this isn't as good as Freaks.
Hardly anything is as good as Freaks. That movie is amazing.
If you say so.
I will say there are a handful of pretty good performances in this movie. I don't know the actors' names because I haven't really seen most of them in anything else, except one of the dwarfs did play a role in The Enigma of Caspar Hauser, but... the acting, at least, is pretty stellar for the most part. But
basically, if John Waters, early John Waters, had been German, this is the kind of movie it would have made.
Okay, that sentence should never be spoken.
It's true. It feels like that sort of like Pink Flamingos. Like, let's just. You know, I get all these dwarves together and I make them do freaky shit.
Well, I'm glad I missed that one.
John Waters should do a Jackass sequel.
I did hear there was one scene, and I forget which scene it was, but Herzog was having trouble convincing the dwarves to do it. And he told them that if they would do it, that he would jump into a cactus bush and let them film it and watch. And they agreed. And so after it was done, he went and jumped into a cactus bush and got badly injured, and everybody laughed at him, and that was that. Which,
So it was like a dignity exchange.
I'm not sure what the moral of that story is, but it's a story.
The moral is Herzog will do anything in service of his movie.
He also ate his own shoe.
He did.
Yeah.
And he was, I assume at least some of you have seen the YouTube clip of him getting shot while doing an interview.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's still just insane to me. But
it was not a significant bullet.
Yes. It's weird, too, how, I'm sorry if I'm kind of going on a tangent here, but how he's kind of become like a recognizable pop culture figure to a much greater degree than he ever was before just in the past few years here.
Mm-hmm.
He's just kind of popping up and stuff. He was on The Simpsons a couple of years ago and on The Boondocks and has been in a couple of bigger movies. And
yeah, the, about 10 know. Minutes of screen time in Jack Reacher as the villain.
Right.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. But I mean, in this day and age, when I mean, celebrity is more instantaneous, that this guy with such a different kind of personality and his own vibe that he brings, that he becomes famous. You know, I have a feeling he's a bit like Morgan Freeman, you know, for the voiceover and the documentaries and the like weird thing he brings, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We used to play this game at work. Where, you know, like one, I don't even remember, it was probably me who started it, I don't remember. But, you know, everybody up there has been asked at some point or another, if someone were to narrate your life, who would it be? And that was my answer, was Werner Herzog. And, of course, everybody's like, who? But, you know, it was, that was he was still the first one I went to, you know, whereas what was myself and one of the other guys in tech, we kind of came to the conclusion that 9 out of 10 people would choose Morgan Freeman immediately.
Yep.
Did any of you? I might go Sam Elliott.
Ooh, nice, Big Lebowski.
Ram.
Did any of you ever hear about the filmmaking boot camp that Werner Herzog was doing for a while? I don't know if he's still doing it.
No.
But it was like this 2 or 3 day filmmaking boot camp, which was supposed to teach aspiring young filmmakers important lessons, and almost none of it had anything to do with the technical aspects of filmmaking, but rather there were classes on, like, how to pick locks, how to survive in the wilderness, wood carving, just these subjects that he deemed essential for any filmmaker before they started making movies.
My favorite Werner Herzog story is the car accident, the Joaquin Phoenix car crash.
Oh, yeah.
Where, you know, some guy just appears out of nowhere, pulls Joaquin Phoenix out of a burning car and says, it's all going to be okay, and then just vanishes into the California Badlands again.
Here's one of those strange situations where Joaquin Phoenix was the less strange person in the anecdote.
I have to ask, did I just hear, like, the first few notes to the Lethal Weapon theme somewhere?
Yes, my wife just texted.
Was that what? I was just like, it's all of a sudden, Steve's telling
whenever
this,
I get,
you know,
whenever I get a text,
he's telling this anecdote about something that happens in California, and there are these, like, southwestern kind of strings going, and it's like, what happened?
I suddenly started feeling melancholy.
When Steve remembers something, do we just get his internal soundtrack?
When I wax nostalgia, I get the Lethal Weapon soundtrack.
Does that mean we're going to get censored? Clark, get the rights to this.
No, it's fair use. It's less than 30 seconds. It's all good.
So, yeah, with that, I guess we should go around and get people's impressions of Werner Herzog's. Let's go with you, Steve.
As a person, I think he's fascinating, and I love him. As a documentarian, I think he's one of the best documentary filmmakers on the go. As a narrative filmmaker, I think he's become considerably more effective in recent years, but I think his early years, he kind of feels like a pointless Terrence Malick. And that may be harsh, but...
harsh, but fair.
I love him, and I love a lot of his work, but so much of his early work, which, I mean, you know, in the film circles, the air quote film circles, it's the early work that really gets the notice. It's stuff like Aguirre, Fitzcarraldo, and that's the stuff that left me cold. That's the stuff that really kind of, yeah, you know, it's okay, but...
Are you remembering back now, Steve?
I am, yeah. But yeah, it's...
Flashback to those traumatic times watching early Herzog movies.
19 and high and watching Aguirre for the first time.
You still had all that hair.
Still had long hair. But yeah, no, it's a... He's an interesting cat, and like I said, as a person, like as a personality, I love him. I think he's absolutely amazing. I think he's one of those, you know, those rare breed of intellectual, like Zen masters out of Hollywood, you know, like, and he's really an intriguing cat, and he's an interesting cat to watch in interviews and stuff like that. He's an amazing interviewee. And just when you hear his, you know, his own inner monologue on his documentary, stuff like Encounters at the End of the World, which was amazing, Cave of Forgotten Dreams, Grizzly Man, like amazing, amazing documentary work. And like his input into those documentaries is really, I think, what gave me such a fine appreciation of him. And having that appreciation, I could enjoy his movies a lot more, you know, but it's... He's definitely a different cat. He's definitely a hard guy to put your finger on.
I've tried. I broke it.
That sells it. What about you, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, I more or less echo what Steve said. Because I have no thoughts that are my own. But... no, I mean, obviously, he's got a very compelling personality, which I think accounts for, well, I mean, it certainly accounts for his unusual approach to filmmaking. And mm-hmm. At the same time, I think perhaps if those outside experiences, the experiences outside of the film, his relationship with Kinski, the scenarios and or the sort of all the complications in getting them made. I'm not sure he would be quite the cultural figure that he is now. I think he'd still be respected, certainly, because he's made some great movies. But it almost seems like his impact is more for how he does it than what he does. Mm. But also... You know, Aguirre, awesome. I like. So
he like it. Andrew like.
That's the level of insight that you get.
This is how Canadians talk about movies.
Is John still alive out there?
He's still here. He hasn't been retired yet. Parting thoughts, John, on
Bad Lieutenant
parting shots.
New Orleans.
And what about you, Clark?
Yeah, I really have a lot of admiration for Werner Herzog. I've always felt that he and Terrence Malick, to me at least, are kind of the two great movie philosophers. And I really think of them both as philosophers.
Falafels?
Yes. I think of him as a falafel, really. I think of them as much as philosophers, as filmmakers, because I feel like they both really have something they really want to say about the world and human nature and nature itself. And I think Herzog has a very unique, distinctive take on the world, and it's one that I find endlessly interesting. I feel like you get a more direct dose of that from his documentary work than from his feature work, though I do really like a lot of his features. And he's somebody who I could listen to for endless hours on end. I think he's just a tremendous guy, a tremendous filmmaker in a lot of regards, and yeah, somebody I'm looking forward to continuing to follow as long as he keeps making stuff, whatever it is.
Oh, I forgot about something I wanted to mention. there is a short film, and I think it's by this the director's name escapes me, but I think it's the same director who did like Man Push Cart.
Ramin Barani.
Yeah, and it's basic. It's like a story of a plastic bag. Imagine that scene in American Beauty. Then scrub that from your brain and make it something good.
I can't now. It's stuck there.
I'm sorry.
I just feel like there's so much. What was it? Pain in the world or sadness in the world?
Beauty. Beauty. Beauty.
It's pain and sadness were the experiences I had watching that
scene. Yeah, no, I don't blame you. But in this case, it was narrated by Werner Herzog.
Oh, nice.
Who was the voice of the plastic bag.
It was a very unusual experience, but it was sort of a neat use of... It was another filmmaker's use of Herzog as a... as a performer, that was very, I would say, effective and cool. And man, the action sequences in that movie, unreal.
While I would agree with a lot of things that were said, that I do find Herzog a bit more interesting as an individual, as a filmmaker. I still enjoy watching most of his fictitious movies. Even like, I always find there's something interesting in there. If not, he doesn't have always enough to like hook you in, depending when the mood strikes you. He's one of those guys that I will just pick a movie, you know, once in a while that I'm like, oh, I'm in the mood for some Herzog tonight. He's not like the type of guy that is made for this podcast where we would have to watch like, you know, all of them in a row, whatever, but he's definitely interesting.
I've come up with a title for the movie. The movie about the plastic bag is called Plastic Bag.
And I mean, I find that interesting of that in his fictitious movies, he's always going into realism, because I know he's also often being accused of like not telling the truth in his documentaries.
I think it's probably important at this point to note that he probably views the two. He doesn't view his documentaries and his narrative films as separately as other people might.
No, exactly.
That's very true. And you know, one of the things I heard that kind of amazed me, Rescue Dawn actually sticks closer to the facts of what really happened than his documentary about the same subject, Little Dieter Needs to Fly. He and the real-life guy made up a few things which they thought would be dramatically compelling for the documentary. And, you know, we're very open about this. Like, yeah, we made it up because we thought it'd be cool. Yeah, I think he's been entirely willing to, and I mean, he doesn't do it in a sort of unethical, secretive sort of way.
No.
But he does feel comfortable with blending fact and fiction in his documentaries to a greater degree than a lot of documentarians are.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I think that's it for Werner Herzog, Steve. I think you have the next choice. Who's the next pick? Who's the next victim?
All right, buckle your safety belts, children. The next one's going to be a real cross. I mean, Baron Werner.
Oh. There goes our humanity.
The next one, we will be tackling the works, if you could call them that. Yeah, we'll call them that. We'll call them the works of controversial public figure, head of an empire, producer, editor, occasional director of movies, Mr. George Lucas, Esquire. Sure to be a fun time.
So thanks again, Clark, for joining us this week.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
It's been a pleasure.
Now, you've got 5 minutes to get to the border.
No, we're not kidding. Run. Hurry.
And I guess we'll see you next Wednesday.
Tuesday. Next Tuesday.
Whatever.